Silicon Valley startups and political candidates share one major trait: disruption. Both are trying to either disrupt an incumbent or offer a bold new idea. This week on Techonomics, host Jason Middleton speaks with a venture capitalist who used to be a major political operative. That conversation starts now.
Hello and welcome back, and thanks for listening. Sometimes, usually either mid or late career, it can be tough to find a way to translate your existing skill set, what you've been doing, with a different industry to a company in a different sector. Kind of like a broadcaster looking to migrate into an internal corporate communications job at, I don't know, Salesforce, for example. This translation of skills is not an issue for political and campaign operatives who are looking for things to do in Silicon Valley, things like venture capital.
Turns out, not just for me, but all the people on my team who come out of government and politics, the transition is a lot less difficult than they expect, because ultimately the same sort of pace, energy, momentum, sense of mission, kind of belief in the underlying candidate or product is all actually very transferable. And so one of the reasons that we've made this switch over reasonably well, I think, is because it turns out that the politics world and the startup world are not that different.
Bradley Tusk helped Michael Bloomberg win an independent run for the mayorship of New York. Tusk then moved on to work with then-Illinois Governor Rob Blagojevich. That governor did land in jail, but Tusk had nothing to do with it. Mr. Tusk is also the principal of Tusk Ventures and the author of The Fixer, My Adventures, Saving Startups from Death by Politics.
Bradley Tusk, founder and CEO of Tusk Ventures.
Yeah, and your new book is The Fixer. Let's talk a little bit about your background before we get into the book, okay? Let's talk about the political operative side of you before you got into tech and, and your holdings position, and how those skills kind of intersect between and maybe even overlap between politics and business, at least with startups.
They really do. So, I mean, the first part of my career was all in government and politics. Was Mike Bloomberg's campaign manager, worked for him when he was mayor at City Hall. I spent 4 years as the deputy governor of Illinois, a couple of years on Capitol Hill as Chuck Schumer's communications director. And what all those skills interestingly taught me is not only how startups can deal with government and politics and should deal with it, but also, in a lot of ways, the pace and energy of a political campaign or a really fast-paced government office is pretty similar to working at a startup. And so it turns out, not just for me, but all the people on my team who come out of government and politics, the transition is a lot less difficult than they expect, because ultimately the same sort of pace, energy, momentum, sense of mission, kind of belief in the underlying candidate or product is all actually very transferable. And so one of the reasons that we've made this switch over reasonably well, I think, is because it turns out that the politics world and the startup world are not that different.
Mr. Bloomberg is making noise about 2020. Maybe you go back into politics in 2020?
Look, there's, you know, a couple of things. One, I think, and he was in San Francisco when a lot of this news broke the other day, so you guys probably saw it up close. And the main point Mike was making is that it's going to be very tough in 2020 for an independent to win. There's a chapter in the book about how we put together an independent campaign for him in 2016. I had agreed to run the campaign. I still think that we would have had a shot, but now after a couple of years of Trump, the country is so partisan and so polarized that the hunger for someone independent, I think, is not going to be as clear in 2020 as it was in 2016. So if someone were to run for president, they probably need to run through one of the parties. And I think his point is, given all of his positions on social issues, he would obviously run as a Democrat.
Okay, that's great. I don't get to ask political questions often on this show, so that's kind of cool. Let's go back to your top answer, because you mentioned there the pacing and the overlap between politics and startups. Now, in politics, you have to it seems like you have to have kind of a malleable position. You have to be able to evolve your position at times. Is that the same kind of thing with startups?
Yes and no. But I think that in both worlds, you have to recognize kind of the political reality of what you're trying to accomplish and not let the perfect be the enemy of the good. With that said, you know, where startups and politics really differ is, for most politicians, probably the only exception I know of is Bloomberg, the means and the end is the same thing. The goal is to get attention. They run for office because they need attention. They serve in office because they need attention. So, you know, what they have to do and say publicly is not only sort of help determine what the outcomes are on their votes or their policy beliefs or anything else, but it's really what they need fundamentally to stay in the job. Whereas for startups, you have to deal with politics. If you don't deal with politics, it's going to come back and bite you in a really bad way. But you're dealing with it more as a means to an end of saying, I want to be able to offer people ride sharing, sports betting, right. home sharing, whatever it is. And I get that to do that, these are regulated industries, right. and there are entrenched interests that I'm disrupting, and they're going to fight back really hard. And I've got to think out ahead of what are they going to do to me, and how do I push back? Because, you know, you may have a brilliant idea and a brilliant platform, but they don't thank you for disrupting them if they punch you in the nose.
And that's a great theme throughout the book. And I want to stay here for a second because, to my mind, regulation tends to favor the incumbent. Where you're coming from, you're helping startups and disruptors. Is that the dynamic? And is there a decent playbook?
So, I mean, effectively, my day tends to be one of two scenarios. The more common one is entrepreneur comes up with a new idea. The laws are kind of silent as to it because if the bureaucrats who wrote the laws could have come up with those ideas, they'd be entrepreneurs and not bureaucrats.
Right.
So entrepreneur starts to launch the product, starts getting market share. The incumbent entrenched interest starts getting nervous. They notice because they write a lot of campaign checks, they lean on the local politician to crack down and say, this isn't allowed, whatever it is. Politician leans on the regulator to do it. And then our job is to A, beat up the entrenched interest and back them off. And then B, convince the politician and regulator that either the law is fine as is and we can do this, or if we have to, change the law, change the regulation to enable us to do it. Mm. That's most of our job. Occasionally it gets even more interesting where it's a field like cryptocurrency or autonomous vehicles or cannabis or drones, where there are no laws, right? Because the idea is completely brand new. You're not really disrupting anyone because no one's in the space in the first place. And there it's more around what should the regulatory framework look like? Who should regulate us? What should the laws be? And in many ways, you know, the startups kind of need some level of regulatory certainty because the only way to separate the good guys and the bad guys is to have some laws to adhere to. I mean, especially like in the crypto space. You know, there are really legitimate exchanges like Coinbase and Circle, which we're investors in, but there's also a lot of scams, right?
Yeah.
And if you're a legitimate player in the space, you actually need some level of regulation and government intervention to differentiate you from the bad guys.
Well, I'm going to use a living example, if I could, because I want to tease this out. This is a fascinating conversation. Local politicians, like you said, okay, incumbents, regulation, and you're trying to disrupt. Okay, I can't imagine a more influential political machine than a car lot in a small, small town, right? So if I own a couple of car lots, right, and say somebody wants to go B2C, somebody wants to sell their car business to consumer and get rid of the car lots in between, I imagine that's going to piss me off, and I'm going to push back against that. If you were building a B2C car company, I mean, how would you circumvent that?
We actually dealt with that scenario in real life for Tesla. And Elon wanted to sell cars directly to consumers. And look, the car dealership model made sense 50, 60 years ago, but today with the internet, you don't really need it. It's just an added cost for everybody. And those car dealers are actually very politically powerful because they're so entrenched in the community. You know, they sponsor the Little League team and the local parade, and they always write checks to every politician. I don't know if you remember the show Friday Night Lights, but Buddy, who was the main booster on the show, he was a car dealer, right? That's what he was. So beating those guys is really, really hard. And what we found in the case of Tesla was we had to be willing to run really vicious campaigns that talked about not just that, you know, Tesla was good for the environment or good for the economy, but the kind of corruption going on where these car dealers are effectively paying local politicians to block competition. What was interesting in that case was Elon actually didn't want to do it and pushed back and said, I'm worried of what these kind of tactics of running, you know, tough opposition research campaigns would have on my reputation, so I'm not going to do it. And as a result, we weren't able to win in some states. A little ironic given now some of the mess he's got himself into from a reputation standpoint.
Right.
But ultimately, these are tough fights. And I think one of the challenges that tech tends to have is because these founders have been so touted and so told how brilliant they are from every moment of their life, they have a hard time understanding that there are certain sectors like government and politics where they don't care. Right. And if you're not willing to fight it out on their terms, it's going to be really hard to win.
We're speaking with Bradley Tusk. He's the founder and CEO of Tusk Holdings, also the author of the new book, The Fixer, Saving Startups from Death by Politics. Let's land on politics for a second. The Columbia Alumni Magazine arrived yesterday, and on the cover it says, is the U.S. election machine coming apart at the seams? And you had a mobile voting project. Can you tell us a little bit about that? And then we'll talk about elections writ large.
Absolutely. So I would say absolutely yes. I'll give an example. So let's say here in New York, we have 8.6 million residents. In both Democratic primaries in 2013 and 2017 for mayor, Bill de Blasio, who's our mayor, got about 300,000 votes. That turns out to be about 3 to 4% of the total population. and the rest of the city effectively didn't participate in the process. And de Blasio, from a political standpoint, very intelligently governed for those 3 or 4% of people who he knew would vote again in the next election. That is not a good way to run a democracy. And the reason why it's so hard to get things done is because turnout is so low and districts are so gerrymandered that in almost every legislative seat around the country, both state, local, and federal, whoever wins the primary wins the general election. And if turnout is, say, 10, 12%, those are the people they govern for. So, like, let's say that you're a Republican congressman from Florida and average turnout in your primary is 12%. You probably know that an assault weapon ban is a good idea. You probably know that having people walking around with AK-47s is not a good thing. Right. But if of that 12%, half of those voters are NRA members, you're not touching it because you're terrified of losing their support in the next election and losing your job. Mm-hmm. Let's say turnout, instead of being 12%, were 60% because people could vote on their phone. Then all of a sudden the NRA goes from being half of the voting block to a tenth of the voting block, and the politics flip completely. What I learned in all my years in government and politics is that most politicians will follow whatever inputs they're given in order to keep the job. So if it's you have to be ultra left-wing or right-wing, they will. If you have to be centrist, they will. They're very adaptable. But it only reflects people who actually vote. The system of voting was built for an agrarian society 250 years ago. Mm-hmm. It doesn't work. People don't show up. And so we have this technology in our pockets now that can allow us to do incredible things, not only enable people to vote through their phones, but do it in a way that's far more secure than the current election system we have. Right. So the first state to try this was West Virginia. We did a pilot program with them in their May primary. We're doing it again in their November general election, where members of the deployed military, so soldiers in Afghanistan or Iraq, could vote in the election on their phones. My foundation, Tuss Montgomery Philanthropies, paid for the cost to administer the election. We've done 4 security audits since the primary. Everything has come back good. So we'll try it again for the general. We're working with a bunch of different cities and states to do municipal elections next year. And my hope is that we can prove out this technology over the next couple of years and get to a place where ultimately everyone can vote in an election on their phone.
Wow. Mr. Tusk, it sounds like you've been crushing it in a couple of different sectors. I want to come back to your VC life for just a second, because as I cover venture capital, I notice the larger incumbents, right, are blocking and tackling. People like Comcast, Walmart, starting their own in-house VC firms and looking to find the next thing, if not to play whack-a-mole. Are you seeing that dynamic playing out, and how do you see it moving forward?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think you're seeing these kind of mega funds get raised. You know, obviously SoftBank, I think, led the trend with the Vision Fund, which I think was $92 billion. But Sequoia just raised $8 billion. So, you know, you have almost this dynamic, almost not only with the American society, right, where you're going to have really, really big venture funds that are effectively focused, you know, kind of working as private equity in a way, because you can't deploy $8 billion into early stage companies because you need to write checks of, say, $50 million or more every single time. And, you know, most of these companies, you know, they're looking to raise $2 million or whatever it is. So you're going to have your big late stage players, and you have funds like ours, Tuss Ventures, where we tend to focus on seed and series A, where we're trying to help a company get off the ground, trying to make sure they don't make stupid political mistakes, and get to a place where then a SoftBank, a Sequoia, and a Cell will invest in them at the Series C or D or something like that. And we've had examples of that. So, for example, we're investors in a company called Lemonade. They provide property and casualty insurance online. We helped them get their insurance licenses in every state. We started investing fairly early on. And by the Series C, SoftBank came in at a really high valuation. And I suspect that they'll end up, you know, kind of owning most of the company. So the trend can work. But I think if you're one of those mid-level $400 million funds, you may be in a little bit of no man's land where you're not big enough to compete with the mega funds, but your check size is too big to kind of write the smaller million-dollar checks that funds like mine are able to do. I think they're going to have some trouble going forward.
That's pretty cool. That's you just described the food chain of VC in a way, and it reminds me of a question I wanted to ask at the top, and I'm sorry I missed it. But would you consider Tusk Holdings as a light touch VC or a more of a heavier touch board kind of thing?
It's funny. We don't really need board seats because we are so engaged in the day-to-day politics of the company that every day at 7 a.m., every portfolio company gets an email from us saying, here's what's going on in the campaign today. So if you take Bird, for example, which is a scooter company that's been in the news in San Francisco a little bit lately, you know, Milwaukee, Philly, Chicago, Boston, Miami, whatever it is, here's where the campaign stands. So we're so entrenched in the company that we're not usually that worried about board seats because we're already in it. But ultimately, the only reason that someone gives me an allocation into a really sought-after round is because they know they're going to have political problems. And the only way to get our help is to give us investment rights. And so that has enabled us to invest in companies like Bird and Circle and Coinbase and Lemonade and FanDuel and a bunch of others, but mainly because we're able to leverage this one unique skill set that we have that at the moment no one else in venture offers.
Well, you have an enviable deal flow going, Mr. Tusk, and you have a fascinating career. Thank you so much for your time this morning. Very much appreciate it. Fascinating talk.
Thanks for having me. It's really fun.
That was Bradley Tusk. Mr. Tusk is the founder and CEO of Tusk Ventures and the author of The Fixer, My Adventures, Saving Startups from Death by Politics. Tusk Ventures helps create a political path for startups who begin disrupting a sector and other businesses start to push back. As for elections, let's swing back around on that mobile voting application idea. The pilot program, incongruously launched in West Virginia, allows men and women to vote who are serving in the military overseas if they are also registered to vote in 24 of that state's 55 counties. The rollout for the Votes, V-O-A-T-Z app, happened in late September. For this round, it works on smartphones and tablets. Voter participation is mission critical for a working democracy. We know that. And West Virginia's Secretary of State is a believer, saying, quote, "I personally would love to see a world one day where everyone can vote securely on their phone," end quote. The technology that secures votes, and likely all of the voting apps that will be following, is blockchain. Now, this is the best working definition of the voting tech that I can find. It's from Slate.com. Blockchain technology allows people to maintain a list of transactions that is stored on all the computers participating in a particular network. These computers work together to verify additions to the list and to encrypt the records so that malicious actors cannot tamper with them. Blockchain is most commonly used to facilitate the mining and trading of cryptocurrencies like Bitcoin, but Votes is taking advantage of the tech to keep track of votes. Now, the first test of this was in May in the West Virginia primaries, and after four independent audits, it was cleared for a rollout in the general election. There are links to all of our sourcing, Mr. Tusk's books, Votes, the app, and more in the show notes for this week. It lives at KGORadio.com.